You, John Tate II, for your willingness to run for office and for taking time to record this program. Welcome and thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Linda.
So, John, I wonder if you could begin by letting our listeners know about your background and what your background in your background prepares you for the assembly seat, and also has your political service as city alderman helped in your decision to run for the office?
Sure. Thanks for asking. So part of the reason I got into politics in the first place was because of my work as a case manager in a group home that I worked in for young men with developmental disabilities and emotional disorders. And it was during that time when I was working with those guys and kind of transitioning them from the youth services system to the adult services system that I discovered and kind of really understood just how critical policy is and how it affects people's lives. What I was finding was as they were transitioning, the resources that were available to them and their families dropped off pretty precipitously. As you know, their diagnosis wouldn't change, their disabilities didn't change, and their family circumstances didn't change. But what was available for them to meet their needs was significantly different. And I understood that to be a decision made at a policy level, at a governmental level, at a state level, more often than not, with several people sitting at a table saying, this is worth funding. And this is not worth funding. And working with a vulnerable population in that way, I really felt compelled to, you know, get a seat at that table and start advocating for those folks who otherwise didn't have a voice or were otherwise ignored or underrepresented. So that motivated me to return to graduate school and get a master's degree in social work, because at the time, running for office was something that required credentials and qualifications. I think November 2016 may have suggested otherwise. But so I returned to graduate school and got my degree, and you know, got really active in other campaigns and volunteering, really understanding the internal workings of politics. So when I graduated last summer, returned to Racine, started really getting engaged in local organizations, attending city council meetings, attending school board meetings, and just getting really a real lay of the land in terms of how our governance was working in the local area. And decided to jump in and run for alderman. I was successful in winning by 4 votes, defeating a 26-year incumbent. And the strategy that I used to do that was really just engaging folks in a way that they had not been engaged for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really like heart-wrenching as I went knock on doors and talk to folks and hear them say, you know, I haven't seen my alderman for, you know, 10, 15 years. And as a person who was getting super energized in the political process and seeing just how critical representation can be for a community, it really broke my heart and just kind of pushed me even further. So, yes, I need to be doing this right now.
Mm-hmm. There's an energy.
Then, you know, that energy, that necessity, and really just looking at the landscape of our democracy when we have just such rampant voter apathy and people are just so disconnected from the process because they don't feel represented because the folks who either represent them have kind of disengaged or disconnected or simply never were too connected in the first place.
Yes.
And that's something that I've been working really hard to change. You know, as an alder, I continue to canvass my neighborhoods and talk to residents about the issues that are most important to them outside of the election cycle. Because too often what I see, you know, for all politics, but particularly for Democratic politics, is that we only show up in certain communities when it's time to ask for their vote.
Yes.
And I'm not okay with that.
And I know you've spoken a great deal about the importance of minority representation in the assembly in the state, and you were raised in a union household with two working parents who did everything they could to put you through school. Why do you think minority representation is important, and has your social service degree impacted on that?
Social work degree. There was a quote that I've always, that's really resonated with me. I think Michelle Nichols, from who played Lieutenant Uhura in Star Trek in the 1960s, was at a banquet of some sort. She tells a story that she was speaking with Dr. Martin Luther King about, you know, potentially wanting to leave the show, and he discouraged her from doing it. He's like, no, don't leave the show. And she was like, well, why? He's like, representation matters. And that's kind of been a tagline that I've run with, you know, ever since, is that people need to be able to see themselves in the people that represent them. And, you know,
Absolutely.
That's not just on the surface. You know, we're seen as a majority-minority community, so yes, in many ways, you know, on the surface, I would be representative of many of the people in the 66th district.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to that, it goes beyond just being able to see yourself, you know, in your skin color, but being able to see yourself in the experiences that the person who represents you has. And as you mentioned, I come from a working class family, and both my parents we're in unions, and you know, I know what it's like to have that struggle that most Americans have. You know, there's statistics that say upwards of 60% of Americans couldn't weather a $500 emergency. That's something that I know. I live that. That's my experience. Like right now, if I were to get into a fender bender and have some damage to my car that costs $500, I'm not sure how I would weather that.
Yep. That's a very middle class situation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm at best middle class, at worst, you know, working poor. And I've experienced that range that a lot of people in Racine and Wisconsin and the country are experiencing right now.
Yep. The environmental issue also looms large in your goals, and I wonder what kind of environmental issues you see that Wisconsin should be improving on. I know you said that this is a state that has pioneered environmentalism, and yet things are in some ways weaker now. What do you see as Wisconsin needs to improve on?
Well, I mean, certainly we need to ensure that, well, one of the biggest things is the DNR over the last several years has just been, you know, gutted in many ways in terms of its funding, in terms of its staff, in terms of the scientists that are available to be reaching out and, you know, testing our environment for, you know, the soils and our water. And without that, you know, we put ourselves at risk, particularly when we're bringing in all these other industries to the area, which is good. It's great to have economic development. It's great to bring back energy industry. But we also have to recognize that industry isn't always motivated to protect the environment if it's not necessarily within the benefit of their bottom line. If we don't have a system and a regulatory body that really focuses purely on the health of our environment and one that is strong and has the ability to enforce some things, then we put ourselves at risk of, you know, returning to the days where waterways and lakes are on fire you know, before we establish the EPA.
And air is dirty.
And the air being dirty and, you know, having beautiful sunsets, but at the cost of our breathing quality, our air quality, like L.A. used to have, you know, in the 90s and 80s. So, you know, as you mentioned, you know, Wisconsin in many ways pioneered the environmentalist movement and, you know, established some of the policies that many others have kind of adopted and rolled into their own communities and state governments to protect our environment and to ensure, you know, there's a fair balance between industry and recreation and just pure love for nature.
Yes.
And over the last several years, we've just really moved away from that. And it's really disheartening to know that a state that has pioneered so many things, whether that's the public sector union or, you know, just a robust environmental protection, you know, policy, that we would be moving away from that. And to what end? You know, right now in Wisconsin, we have statistics that say that we've had the greatest loss of middle-class people out of all the states. And I don't think that's a surprise when we've, you know, gutted and attacked public sector unions and, you know, demonized teachers and tried to split workers in every which way. You know, it just flies in the face of so many things that have made Wisconsin great.
We are the state that pioneered Earth Day, for one thing. That's, of course, a national event now. This touches a little bit on the Foxconn deal, and I wanted to ask you how you see this. I know it's an opportunity for jobs in this area. How do you see this in terms of upsides and downsides?
Yeah, what was that last part?
What do you see this as in terms of upsides and downsides for the Foxconn deal?
Well, I mean, the upside's fairly obvious. You know, there's the economic development that's supposed to come along. There's the jobs that will be available. There's the kind of just natural press that occurs for Wisconsin as we have this major corporation coming in, and, you know, a lot of other businesses and marketing entities might be looking at Wisconsin as a place to invest or even put down roots. So those are all phenomenal things that can occur. My worry is that we lose more than what we may gain, because, you know, economics is one piece, but, you know, if your community isn't just more than money, then you're not much of a community in some ways. And I want to ensure that, you know, whatever comes to Foxconn, that it ends up being, you know, equitable, and, you know, all of us are able to benefit from that, particularly those who most need the employment. I mean, the city of Racine has been vying for number one and two in terms of highest unemployment in the state of Wisconsin. And right now there aren't many provisions that's in any sort of legislation, whether it's for the state, county, or otherwise, that would work to remedy that. We have activists in the community who are fighting extremely hard to ensure that we can get some documentation, something in paper that says that, you know, there's going to be a certain level of inclusion, you know, for minority and, you know, otherwise higher represented underemployed people in this. And, you know, one of them is Alfonso Gardner, who's talking about a 20-20-20 program, which I completely support, which essentially says that 20% of the jobs that would happen at Foxconn would be to Racine County residents. 20% of the construction contracts would go to Racine and Wisconsin businesses, and then 20% of the construction hours would go toward apprenticeships, which would essentially create a workforce that would be able to continue to do the construction that's supposed to come with the secondary growth that we're expecting from this project. So I think if it's going to be everything that we want it to be and that some tout it to be, we're going to have to be really intentional. Mm-hmm. In creating policies and contracts and things on paper and, you know, penalties if those goals aren't met. Because too often we put these inclusion standards in place, but there's no teeth to them. So
that's where they
say, well, yeah, we were supposed to hit 30%, but we hit 10% and, you know, and they just stop there.
Yes.
So we really have to be intentional to ensure that this is beneficial for everybody. And I do want to acknowledge that, you know, while there are a lot of things missing from the initial legislation that would have allowed me to support it, I do want to acknowledge a lot of our more local officials who are working extremely hard to ensure that we have environmental provisions and that there are additional kind of layers to protect, you know, our environment and some of our taxpayers, and to try and get the jobs, you know, to the people who most need them. So, you know, there's local county supervisors who are working on those things very hard. And I do want to acknowledge that despite, you know, the maybe the shortcomings of some of the legislation that came from the state.
Mm-hmm. I come from an education career, and I wonder how you see the issues of public schools and vouchers. What do we need to see happen to create stronger public schools?
Well, probably the first thing we could do is restore funding to our public schools. You know, our current governor likes to tout that he's just signed the largest increase in Wisconsin history to our public schools. What he doesn't mention is that it's still not to the level where it was prior to his administration. And it's only the largest because it's been decreased so much over the last 7 years. So getting back to where our schools should be funded in the first place might be a first step. In addition to that, you know, as we talk about voucher schools, it's really important to have a system in place and have standards in place that ensure that any public funds that go to a school that is not a public school also is accompanied by some real standards that say that those schools are going to be held accountable to the exact same standards as our public schools. One of the things I see that often happens with our voucher programs is they'll receive students from the public schools, and they'll receive the funds for those students. And then after the headcount is completed, which is essentially the cutoff point where they can keep those funds for the remainder of the school year, many of those students will get sent back to the public schools. So what we see happening is students with higher needs, more challenges, end up in the public school system, while students with fewer needs and lesser challenges end up in the voucher system, but the voucher system ends up having more funds for those students by virtue of kind of manipulating the headcount system. And that's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to continue to have a system where we have, you know, private, you know, less accountable, but not completely unaccountable, but just held less to a lesser standard than our public schools, we have to ensure that also it's equitable with the usage of those funds. So if a student doesn't remain there for the entire school year, that money that's supposed to be allotted for that student should return to whichever school system they're in.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've spoken a lot about the value of having a regional transportation authority in this area. Why is that important, and what are the issues with the transportation system?
Right. Well, so right now, particularly for Racine, we don't have a very robust public transportation system. We have the Bell Urban System, which was recently rebranded to the RIDE system, R-Y-D-E. And it's fairly limited in the region that it covers. It's fairly fractured in its funding. We kind of require, it's kind of an opt-in sort of thing where we need our surrounding municipalities to want to pay in to ensure that, you know, everyone in the region is able to kind of benefit. And it's, again, the region's much larger than what the service covers. And most recently, during our third event's budget talks, they were discussing, you know, pulling their funding from the Bell Urban System, from the RIDE system, which would essentially cut out the routes that go to Sturtevant, which includes the IMET Center for Gateway and the DMV. So imagine how are Ruthenians and Mount Pleasant folks who don't have vehicles supposed to benefit from the education that's occurring and the training that's occurring for this Foxconn that's happening at the IMET Center? And then how are folks who are supposed to be able to vote supposed to get IDs and identification if they can't get to the DMV to vote? So, I mean, there's multiple issues that are affected by having access to good public transit. Mm-hmm. And the absence of a transit authority really prevents that pooling of resources and that broad and efficient viewing of our transportation system. In addition to that, it prevents us from having a larger system that connects our rail. So years ago, we were talking about KRM, Kenosha, Racine, Milwaukee Rail, connecting all three of these great municipalities to Chicago. And we're the 12th largest economic region in the world when you consider Milwaukee to Chicago. And the fact that Racine is kind of cut out from that, we shouldn't be surprised that we end up with the first and second highest unemployment in the state when we're so disconnected from where all the jobs are kind of existing. And when folks don't have money to own a car, you know, how do we expect them to get to the jobs that are, you know, 1, 2, 10, 20 miles away from where they live? Mm-hmm. Except when we have these, you know, hearing a story that a guy bikes, you know, 4 hours a day to a job. Those are unnecessary things that we shouldn't have to be dependent strictly on one means of transportation, vehicular, to get where we need to go, particularly as we're looking towards moving, you know, trying to cater to a new generation that isn't so into having their own vehicles. Mm-hmm. You know, millennials, which I am, by and large, like to not own a car and like to be able to have a system where they can get around without having to own a car. And because we don't have it, we're missing the boat in many ways to attract, you know, new generation of workers and residents and people who want to put down roots and start families. So it's important that we have a robust system mm-hmm. that can transport people to and where they need to go.
A frustrating issue to many people, not only in the area, but in the state and the national level, is the growing partisanship. And I often think that the separation by party at the state level, when issues are discussed in separate groups, feeds that mm-hmm. That partisanship. Is there something you could see changing, or do you see ways that you could see avenues for Democrats and Republicans to work together on more issues at the state level?
Well, part of the reason I see it such a huge divide between the two, because it hasn't always been this way. I was not too long ago doing some research, and there was an article that just kind of illustrated how the partisan divide on the national level has kind of gone. So, you know, there are fewer folks who are further on each end of the spectrum, you know, 60 years ago, but they were still identifying as separate parties, but they were just less separate in terms of the ideology. Now it just gets broader and broader. But one of the things I see contributing to that is really money in politics. When we have a significant amount of money that is influencing or driving our legislators and not so much their constituency, that affords kind of folks the ability not to respond to the diverse opinions of their constituency. And when we have, you know, very specific ideologies funding incredible amounts or pouring incredible amounts into our political process, I think that's a huge contributor in a legislator not wanting to compromise at all because they may lose their funding that got them into office or that helped significantly help them get them into office. So one of the biggest things that we'll have to do for our democracy overall, but particularly Wisconsin, is really bring down some strong and clear regulations as far as where money and how money influences our political process. And, you know, what we've seen over this administration is a lot of dialing back of regulatory statutes for our political process and funding thereof. I think we shouldn't be surprised that, you know, there's a much larger divide between Democrats and Republicans and really just trying to problem solve for the state when there is such a big influence of external money on our races and on our politics and not so much influence on our voters, especially after the gerrymandering that happened in 2010 where, you know, virtually almost every district in the state is very strongly, or almost every district in the state is very strongly safe for whichever party holds that seat. And when that's the case, you know, there's no need almost to hear what the other side of your constituency is saying because there's no chance for that other side to influence whether you're reelected or not. Okay. And that's not okay. And that ultimately hurts our democracy and it hurts our political discourse. So, again, it's not a surprise when we have money and extremely partisan gerrymandering influencing our politics in such a way that there's no need for a conversation across the aisle.
Well, John, this time has gone so fast, so I want to ask you if just in a minute you'd be able to make a statement to our listeners about why you believe you're the best candidate for the 66th Assembly District, and again in about a minute.
That's the challenge for me. Okay. Well, you know, right now in this race, what we have is two young progressive Democrats, and if you were to go up and down the list of issues, you probably wouldn't see very much daylight, I could imagine. So what this race really comes down to is representation and which of the two of us in this moment for Racine, Wisconsin, for the 66th District, best represents the voice that needs to be heard in Madison. And when I say this moment, I'm referring to the moment that Racine identified, that Racine was identified as the fourth worst place in America for black people, a moment that says we're constantly vying for one and two for unemployment, a moment that says, you know, working people are struggling more than ever, and our middle class has been decimated more than any other state in this country. So when we say representation, it's really about which of the two candidates really knows those experiences and can speak to those experiences in such a way that's effective. I think I'm that candidate because I come from a working class family, because I'm a social worker and I have the ability to understand all the challenges that people are experiencing, regardless of where they come from or what their race is or what their wealth is or what their gender is. And it's so important that we have a voice in Madison that not only understands academically what's going on and what the challenges are, but also understands experientially, because that's really what our representation should look like, and that's really what our representation is about.
Thank you, John, so much for joining us today. We congratulate you on your past impressive work, and we wish you the best on your future advocacy and action. And now, joining us for part two of this program is candidate Greta Neubauer, who is vying against John Tate to become the representative for the 66th Assembly District. This special election will be held next Tuesday, December 19th, and will determine the Democrat who will run in the final legislative election in January. These two interviews give you, the voter, the opportunity to hear the issues and to vote for the candidate of your choice. So if you are in the 66th Assembly District, please be sure to vote on Tuesday. So first, I want to thank you, Greta, so much for your willingness to run for office and for taking time to record this program today. We welcome you and thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you so much for doing this program, for informing the voter, and for having this conversation with me.
Great, thank you. So, Greta, I wonder if you could just begin by letting our listeners know about your background and what about your background prepares you for the assembly seat. Also, has coming from a political family, has that helped you in your decision to run for office, too?
Sure. My name is Greta Neubauer. I am a fifth-generation resident of Racine, Wisconsin, and I grew up, born and raised in Racine. I certainly grew up in a family that believed that being involved in public service was very important. And I started working on political campaigns when I was pretty young, knocking on doors for local candidates. And the first election that I was really involved in was the Obama campaign in 2008. I ran Racine High School Students for Obama after taking a bus down to Springfield, Illinois to hear the president, the future president, announce that he was going to be running for office. So that was a really important moment for me. It was really critical for me to see a candidate that so spoke to hope and change in, you know, as even as a young person was able to see, you know, all of the ways in which this society was unequal, all of the challenges that people in Racine were facing. And particularly something that was always motivating to me was, you know, seeing corporate power in the U.S. continue to hurt people in this community and more broadly. And specifically for me, you know, that was the fossil fuel industry mortgaging my generation's future in regard to environmental issues and climate change. So I was really involved in the Obama campaign. After, you know, he was elected, I did feel disillusioned by seeing the things that I, you know, had really hoped, some of the things I really hoped that he would do, he wasn't able to do. And really came to understand that we needed to have people outside of government pushing on our elected officials as well, holding them accountable, supporting them to be able to take the kind of actions that they wanted to. Mm-hmm. And so I joined the environmental movement and became very involved as a national leader in a movement called Fossil Fuel Divestment. We were holding corporations, the fossil fuel industry, accountable using the same tactics as students used and people, you know, off campus used in the South African apartheid divestment movement. And started a campaign on my campus, helped co-found a national organization that went on to support, you know, the majority of the campaigns that were running in the U.S. At one point, that movement had a high of 400 campaigns on university campuses and college campuses around the country. Mm-hmm. So ran that organization when I graduated from college. We at that point had 12 staff, and as I said, we're supporting students around the country to get involved in political work, get training and mentorship, and understand themselves as part of this broader movement, you know, that was pushing our both our elected officials and holding these industries accountable, these rogue industries accountable. When Trump got elected, I felt that it was the kind of moment that required young people like myself and people who were part of and connected to, you know, work outside of the electoral process to get back involved mm-hmm. in electoral work. And I think it's really important that people who are connected to social movements, who understand themselves as organizers, run for office. Uh-huh. And so really how I understand this seat and this moment is, you know, we're not able to get the kind of progressive legislation passed that we want to right now, but I'm hoping to use, you know, all of those experiences. And most recently, I worked for Corey Mason up in the Capitol, right. You know, all of those experiences to help other people run for office, to get other young people thinking that engaging in political work, you know, is something that's hopeful as opposed to it's just a scary future for all of us. And so really excited about the possibility of using this seat to be part of this, you know, new wave of the Democratic Party that we're seeing around the country right now. We're feeling a lot of momentum. And I think with 2018 right around the corner, we do have, you know, a really exciting possibility for what this moment could mean for the Democratic Party, for a progressive vision, for young people getting involved in politics.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's been the youth presence that actually has pushed the environmental issue. And in Wisconsin, we have some definite places where we've stepped back from being that environmental state that we were.
Right, definitely.
A very frustrating issue to many people is the growing partisanship both at the state and national level. And I often think that separation by party at the state level when issues are discussed, you know, the Republicans go one room and the mm-hmm. Democrats the other. Mm-hmm. Is that something you could see changing? Or in other words, could you see avenues for Democrats and Republicans to work together on more issues at the state level?
Yes, I hope so. I mean, I think that the state of our democracy right now is very troubling, both because we have a president who, you know, seems to flout the democratic process entirely and not really take very seriously so many of the values and principles that many of us believe to be at the core of our democracy. But also because we have this extreme level of partisanship. And mm-hmm. I think what we see there is, you know, a lot of people that don't actually reflect the nuanced positions that their constituents hold, right? So I'm knocking on doors right now. I've knocked on, I think, almost 4,000 doors mm-hmm. during the course of this campaign. And, you know, most people want to talk about funding public schools, bringing good jobs to this community, and protecting the Great Lakes. You know, mm-hmm. those are the issues that people in Racine are really concerned about. And of course, there are other things that come up. There's healthcare, right? There's making sure that we're taking care of our immigrant brothers and sisters. There's public transit. But these are not often the core issues that, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans are highlighting, because those issues aren't, you know, the ones that maybe get the big funders excited about putting money in for the campaign, right? And there are many people, for example, you know, that I talk to who are hunters or fishers, right? But they're not saying the NRA represents me, right? Mm-hmm. They're saying we want to be able to safely hunt and fish in Wisconsin, and we don't believe that, you know, minors should be allowed to carry guns like we just saw pass in the legislature, right? So I really do think that there's hope in that we've reached such an extreme level of partisanship that I think so many people are recognizing, you know, this is not working right now.
And you had mentioned, I think, in the debate that or it was in the paper, that youth could see infrastructure as an area where Democrats and Republicans could come together.
What needs
to happen in the area of that?
Yeah, so, you know, we saw with the most recent budget, I was in the Capitol working for Corey Mason while the budget was going through. And we saw Republicans really struggling to, you know, compromise within their own party on infrastructure, specifically, you know, road infrastructure. And we saw a number of Republicans saying, we need to have some common sense legislation here that allows us to not kick the can further down the road, put off, you know, existing construction projects that are going on and continue to let our roads fall apart. And then we saw, you know, real ideological Republicans saying we refuse to raise taxes of any kind, right? If we had continued to have the gas tax indexed in Wisconsin to the rate of inflation, we would have $1.4 billion right now to be spending on our roads, to be putting into public transit, right? And as it is, we have, you know, the far ideological side of this has made it such that we are really letting people in Wisconsin down. And we're not holding ourselves to a very high standard when it comes to providing goods and services for our citizens. And I also, you know, as a very young person, understand this to be something that is going to fall on my generation. And at that point, it's going to cost much more, and it's going to fall much harder on the people who, you know, cannot afford to be fixing up their cars when they hit a pothole and, you know, they've got damage. Mm-hmm. I fear that we'll have more regressive taxes, right, that will hit low-income people the hardest, like tolls or increased vehicle registration fees. So I think it's really important that we do find compromise there. I think it's possible. There's a thinker in Madison, a Quaker thinker. I don't know if you're familiar with him, Linda, but Parker Palmer, who talks a lot about these issues. And one of his books, Healing the Heart of Democracy, has been very influential to me. And really, it's about listening, right? And it's about bringing more people into the democratic process. And, you know, this campaign for me, really a lot of it has been about listening and just talking to folks and hearing what they're concerned about. And as you said, and as I said, right, there's just a lot more shared values and policy that would help the people of Racine that I think is something that we can accomplish across party lines.
I think it was Maya Angelou said we are far more alike than we are different. I come from an educational background, and so I wonder how you see the issues of the public schools and vouchers, and what do we need to see happen to create stronger public schools?
Sure. So, you know, I think for me, a lot of the challenges that we're seeing right now in the Racine public schools are tied very directly to Act 10 and to budget cuts. So Racine schools are struggling, and then we've got a cycle of privatization going on right now where, you know, there's more and more pushing from the state level to invest, to take resources out of public schools and invest in charter and voucher schools. And then we see our schools struggle because we don't have the resources to meet the needs of our children, you know, specifically students with disabilities, English second language learners. You know, if students are coming from a low-income background, often we need to be putting more resources into supporting them to succeed in our public schools, to remove barriers. And we don't have, teachers do not have what they need right now. And I've talked to many teachers throughout this campaign who are struggling. And many folks I knew who were part of, you know, folks I've known from my childhood who were part of the Act 10 conversations and, you know, occupation up in the Capitol and are seeing every day the impacts of that, you know, amongst teachers, their ability to have agency in the classroom, their feeling of, you know, dignity and respect for the work that they're doing. And so I think, you know, as a legislator, I would do my best to continue fighting for teachers and for public schools like Corey Mason did before us.
Right.
And I, as I said, I think this cycle of privatization is hurting our schools. And then what we see, right, is we take money away from the public schools. They struggle. And then Robin Voss is able to say, well, these schools are failing, so I think we should mandate a state takeover, right? Mm-hmm. Like the Opportunity Schools and Partnership right. Program. Or we should divide up our school district. We should allow the villages to break off from the city of Racine. I was working for Corey Mason when that was proposed. I was running those numbers with folks from the school district, right? We saw that it would be about a 70% white district in the villages and about a 70% student of color district here in Racine. That is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. That is segregated schools. Mm-hmm. And I saw Robin Voss stand there on the floor of the assembly and say, that's not what's going on here. You're making this up. This is not real. And we cannot allow that kind of leadership to continue. People in Racine will not stand for that.
I think that a lot of people don't realize that the money that goes to the voucher schools comes right out of the money that goes to public schools, and that people who used to pay to go to a private or a parochial school now just get paid for their kids to go there, assuming they're at a certain income level. But there's been a definite shift in the money, and then you get a population that is... you know, it's very difficult, so to keep the public school strong.
Yes.
You emphasize rebuilding the middle class and supporting labor. Why is that such an important goal, and how can you assist in that arena? And perhaps you want to mention the Foxconn deal also.
Sure. So at one time, Racine was one of the best cities in the country specifically for African Americans to live, right? We had a very strong middle class here. We had good union jobs. My dad often tells the story of being at Case High School and people either dropping out of school or graduating and walking over to the Case plant and getting a good job and making a good life for their family. And for so many people in Racine, I think that dream, that American dream, you know, of a good life and being able to do more than just make ends meet, but have stability and be able to support their kids to get a good education and feel like they have opportunities is just falling further and further out of reach. We are the fourth worst city for African Americans to live in the country. This is unacceptable. We have the highest unemployment rate in the state. It's been that way by year-end statistics for the past 26 years, my entire life. And we also have schools that are really struggling, and I think all those things are very linked. And so the way I understand this moment is we do have an opportunity with Foxconn coming to this area. I don't think that Racine got enough out of that deal, right? We did not see local hire provisions, diverse hire provisions, union contracts, or strong enough environmental protections. But we do have the possibility of good middle-class jobs, specifically in construction. Those jobs start in March and April, coming to this area. So I am hoping that as a state legislator, I can do everything I can to make sure we've got resources for job training, for public transit, that we're removing as many barriers as possible for people in Racine to get some of those jobs. And one proposal that's been put forward specifically by the African American community is 20-20-20 provisions. This is 20% minority and women hire, 20% contracts with minority and women-owned businesses. And 20% minority and women in pre-apprenticeship program, in the pre-apprenticeship program at Foxconn. So I think that is a really good step. I would certainly be very supportive of that. And I would also be advocating for resources at the state level. You know, if we can put $3 billion, if we can hand $3 billion to Foxconn, we should be able to invest in the public transit that would allow people to get from the city of Racine to the Foxconn plant. And we should be able to invest in the workforce development programs here in Racine, pre-apprenticeship, pre-apprenticeship, that would allow people to be getting those jobs. And beyond Foxconn, I think we need to be putting forward, you know, a powerful vision about the kind of jobs that people in this community need and deserve. And I think we need to be raising the minimum wage. I think we need to be doing everything we can to support unions and the labor movement to be strong. I don't know how we rebuild the middle class in this community if we do not have people making $15 an hour at the minimum, if we don't have people being represented by a union. You know, I think we've tried trickle-down economics in this country. We've tried, you know, very open laws for trade in this country, and Racine has been hit maybe harder than, you know, almost any. We've been hit amongst the hardest of any community in the country because of the kinds of policies that have been put in place in the past few decades. So I think it's really important that we continue to fight for the middle class here, that we support folks to have all of the resources and opportunities that they have to get good jobs. That's public education, that's public transit, right? That's supporting people to be removing those barriers that I talked about, getting driver's licenses, access to childcare. And it's also making sure that we are, you know, encouraging and bringing the kind of business to Racine that's going to provide those long-term jobs, you know, with accountability to the community. And one other thing I'll mention, particularly because, you know, I am focused on making sure that we keep our Great Lakes clean and making sure that we are building an economy that sustains this community, is I'm an advocate for what I like to call a Green New Deal, right? This is government investment in job training and in the kinds of new technologies and infrastructure that we're going to need to take us forward. And what that could look like, right, is money for lead paint abatement in this community. We've got a lot of houses with lead paint. It's really bad for people, right? It's poisoning people. We could be investing in, you know, training people to be taking out that lead paint and making our citizens healthier. We could be investing in weatherization, which would cut down on fossil fuel use and save people money, building solar. There's a lot of possibilities for Racine, and I'm very excited I'm elected to this seat to work with Mayor Mason and other people who share this vision for, you know, making Racine a green city that has great jobs for people. Mm-hmm.
Many of us worry about the issue of free and fair and accessible voting, something that we wonder about in recent years with the demise of the Government Accountability Board in Wisconsin to a partisan body. Mm-hmm. Do you see some steps to assure fair elections are happening in Wisconsin?
I do. So, you know, I think we all were very, very concerned, particularly when we saw how many people were kept away from the polls in the last presidential election. You know, it's to some degree there's speculation here, but it's very possible that Wisconsin would have gone a different way if we hadn't had such restrictive voter ID laws here. So first of all, I think we need to get rid of the voter ID law. It both keeps people away who are showing up at the polls with the wrong address or forgetting their ID, and it also intimidates a lot of voters who don't know if they have what it takes to vote and or feel like, you know, they're missing some step in the process. So I think that is a really important step. And I think, like you said, we've got a lot of government agencies who have just been chronically underfunded under the Scott Walker administration. And so making sure that we are funding the agencies that are going to keep our elections free and fair and doing everything we can to make sure that those are nonpartisan. And these are critical steps for Wisconsin.
Okay, Greta, thank you. This time went so fast, so we have to ask you in about a minute if you could finally make a statement to our listeners about why you believe you are the best candidate for the 66th Assembly District. And probably about a minute.
The way I understand this moment is that it's not about specific individuals or specific elections. It's about a moment that we're seeing around this country. It's about reclaiming our democracy and standing up for our progressive values in a time that is very scary. But I understand this moment to have a lot of hope, and I really hope to use my experience working on political campaigns for the past 10 years, running a nonprofit that was focused on getting young people involved in political work, and working up in the Capitol to bring folks together, to bring more people into this process, to lift up the leadership and organizing work by the faith community, by unions, by teachers that's already happening in Racine, and bring that to the Capitol. I think we have an opportunity to put forward a progressive and hopeful vision, and I think that we can start winning more elections if we do that work together. I hope to be someone who is a leader amongst leaders in that process and continue to support other people to get involved in political work.
Thank you, Greta, for joining us today, and we congratulate you on your past impressive work, and we wish you the best on your future advocacy and action. Take care, and thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Linda.
This has been part two of a Community Matters interview program focusing on the two candidates for the Wisconsin 66th Assembly District. This special election is being held next Tuesday, December 19th, and we interviewed Greta Neubauer and John Tate. So if you are in the 66th Assembly District, please remember to vote and get out there and make your vote count. Thank you.
You're listening to WGTD HD.